Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Welcome to episode 130 of the podcast, everybody, with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel. A delayed one this week, Andrew. Slightly delayed because, well, for good reason, I think. We've been waiting for the 911 GT3 RS embargo, the new GT3 RS embargo, to lift because you've driven it at Silverstone, and you can tell us all about it. I just want to know, did you feel like you got beneath the skin of the car? I know there's no road driving.
No, you can't, can you? I drove it, you know, this was no more than bad luck. I only drove it in the wet. But I only drove it on the track. And, you know, I did ask, their point would be that if they let me drive it on the road, I just said, can I just drive it? They said the cars weren't registered, which I'm sure they weren't. So I just said, can I just drive it around the perimeter road at Silverstone, which is a private road? And they said, if we let you do that, we have to let everyone do that. They did have a very limited number of cars and a few journalists to get through it. So I haven't driven it on the road. So I don't think you can say you've got under the skin of any car wearing a number plate without having driven it on a public road. So no, I haven't. Have I got under the skin of it in the very narrow confines of a wet Grand Prix circuit at Silverstone? You betcha.
Okay.
And,
all right, good.
And there's lots and lots and lots to talk about it there. And I know you're going to go to Dunsfold soon and have another go in it, aren't you?
That's just next week. So, I mean, it's unusual, but there are two events very close, both on track.
And hopefully, just pray that it's dry. I mean, it was, as we will discuss. I mean, even in the wet. And actually, to an extent, because it was wet, I mean, the thing about this car, I know we'll talk about it later on, the thing about the car is a downforce car. It's a downforce car like no other Porsche that has ever been. And actually, wet weather is quite a good medium in which to illustrate that fact. Not as good, it has to be said, as following Porsche's top instructor, who's just driving a standard GT3. And to watch him flailing around while I just sat there and sat and steered the car was as instructive as anything you could ever possibly seek to arrange. Yeah, it was. So we'll get into that. The embargoes, you know, driving embargoes, I'm sure everyone listening to this know, they're these things that manufacturers impose. And, you know, they are, nobody likes them, but they are a condition of you getting in the car. You know, you abide by the embargo, or you don't drive the car. And they do it so that everybody can drive the car without fear of some other publication beating them to the story. And then they have a particular minute, which is, on this particular occasion, 1 minute past 11 o'clock at night, British summer time, tomorrow as we're recording this, Tuesday night, which is obviously midnight European, Central European time. And then the whole world, or certainly everybody who's driven the car, gets to publish it exactly the same time. So it's all done in the interests of fairness. which is fine and fair enough, but it does mean, in this particular example, we've had to delay the publication of this, or the broadcast of this podcast, by 24 hours just because we thought it's too important a car to leave until next week when the whole world would have discussed it.
Well, that's right, yeah. I mean, we can't wait a week because your timelines, your feeds will all be flooded with GT3 RS reviews. And ours had to be in there, didn't it? We can't wait until next week when the sort of when all that energy has gone. And embargoes, yeah, I mean, we could break the embargo, but we wouldn't know about it for the next one, would we? And probably, in some cases, there are even... I don't know if this has ever been... if a fine has ever been imposed, but we've been... made quite aware that they could be.
Oh, we have. I'm sure you have too. You have made to sign pieces of paper.
Yeah.
Which commit you to a certain financial penalty if you break the embargo. A financial penalty, you know, numbering in the tens of thousands of euros. Porsche haven't done that. There are certain other manufacturers who have. I don't know anyone who's been made to pay a fine, but then again, you know, if you're into it for tens of thousands of euros, you're probably not going to break the embargo, are you? You know, I find the whole thing fairly unedifying. It would be lovely if it was all done on a shake of the hand and that sort of thing, but I don't think that's the modern world anymore. And also, to be fair to the manufacturers, there have been, you know, and you and I know journalists who, you know, were they not incentivized otherwise, would just break embargoes, and plenty have. And, you know, it's just not the way the world works. And people say, oh, that's you getting into bed, you know, too closely with the car manufacturers, and it's all, you know, chummy and everything else. But, you know, what do you want us to do? Not drive the car? It's, you know, that's the choice. You know, respect the embargo and get to drive the car, or don't respect the embargo, and you could still drive the car, but you'll never drive another. And I don't think that's doing anyone any favours, us not being able to talk about driving Porsches anymore. So, you know, we play the game.
It's just the way it works. Just the way it works. Okay, well, we'll come back to the GT3 RS shortly. First of all, I just want to play you a very short snippet from... Andrew, your most recent Last Blast podcast with, I can't quite believe this, Adrian Newey.
Yeah.
The most successful Formula One designer ever. And this is a 1 hour and 40 minute interview.
Yeah. He said I had 20.
Bloody hell. How lucky were we to get almost 2 hours of his time? I mean, what's that worth? What do you have to pay?
God, I haven't thought about it that. I guess, yes, if you just rung up his agent or his manager or whatever and said, we'd just like Adrian, an hour and 40 minutes of Adrian's consultancy time for our new
it's
racing car or whatever.
Yeah,
he wouldn't do it for a pint, would he?
No, not likely. So we were very grateful to him and the people he works with, but very lucky to get that time with him. And let me just play this quick clip. It's just a very funny anecdote about working with Ron Dennis.
Ron wanted me to come along to a race, the next race was Hungary, which I went along to. But by then I'd been working there for about 2 weeks and inherited John Barnard's old office with kind of floor-to-ceiling mahogany wood panelling, dark wood panelling, with black window frames, a mahogany desk, dark brown carpet. So anyway, when you're working, I was working crazy hours trying to catch up because it was a very late start, 1st of August. By the end of that, it was this darkness was getting a bit depressing. So I said to the factory manager, look, while I'm in Hungary for the race, can you brighten it up a bit? Here's a Farrow and Ball colour chart.
Yeah.
I quite like the duck egg blue. So can you repaint the panels duck egg blue? Get me a lighter brown chair or something and say a light beige carpet. Yep, no problem. So I went away, came back on Monday, and it'd done it all. And it completely transformed it. Now felt bright and cheery and everything. Anyway, that Monday evening, Ron came in about 6 o'clock and he stood in the doorway and he started gulping like a goldfish. And started going more red and then purple. And I thought he's going to have a heart attack. And he finally spun on his heels and walked out.
The Last Blast podcast is sponsored by Footman James, a car insurance company unlike any other. Footman James exists right at the heart of the car enthusiast scene in the UK, holding regular car meets, publishing reports into the health of the classic car scene in this country. And yes, sponsoring the best car podcast out there. Thank you, Footman James. To find out more, visit footmanjames.co.uk. So that's why he's a good interview, you know. Well, he's funny, but he's also searingly honest, isn't he? And he doesn't dodge any of your questions, even the tricky ones.
Yeah,
and there are some tricky ones in there.
Yeah, when, you know, I sort of went in there wondering whether I was going to bring up the whole Senna thing. And I just kind of thought, oh, do you know, I was almost a journalist. I almost thought, well, you can't not. And I, you know, I admire the bloke for his response to that as much as I've admired him for anything he's ever designed, because, you know, his answer was so straight down the line. It didn't duck it at all. It presented the facts. You know, I think the truth is that no one will know. I mean, I think everybody knows that, you know, suspected steering column failure was part of what happened. And I don't think anyone will know, absolutely without a shadow of a doubt, whether that is what killed the man. But talk about, you know, some modern politicians ought to, you know, kind of get hold of this and have a listen. Talk about the art of not passing the buck, but just standing up and saying, okay, fine, I didn't actually design that particular bit myself, but I was responsible. I led the department. I signed it off. It's on me. And I have to live with that. I just admire the bloke so much for that honesty and, you know, and courage, when it would have just been so easy to say, oh, well, you know, yeah, it was all looked into, we're all exonerated, move on. Next question. Didn't do that at all.
Yeah, he answered it honestly, and he took responsibility. It was amazing. So that full episode is on the TI app and website, the-intercooler.com.
Can I just also say that, you know, plugging things furiously as we are, Last Blast has just been a wonderful thing for us to do. And I'm not talking about in commercial terms or anything else. It's just been a real privilege to go and talk to the guys. And there are so many already. We've now got, what, this is the fifth that we've done?
Yeah.
So Chris Hoy, the fifth
one will be out this week. Yeah.
Fifth will be out this week. So we've done Chris Hoy, we've done Andy Wallace, we've done
Adrian Hallmark,
and now Adrian. So two Adrians. Gosh, consecutive Adrians.
Back to back.
And we've got two more to go in this series. And then we're going to do another. I'm actually interviewing someone on Friday for the next series. I'm just so excited about it, but we can't really talk about that, can we?
Yeah, but it's a good one. It's a very, very good one. So you do need to be a TI subscriber to listen to these episodes in full. So there you go. You know, maybe now is the time to go and sign up if you haven't already. Okay, before we get onto the GT3RS, let's talk a little bit about your weekend.
Can we not?
Because I think this... no, I think we do have to. Because I think this weekend, you've often said it's one of the highlights of your year.
Usually, sort of racing year.
But it wasn't this time.
But it wasn't. This is every year me and my family go and attempt to do the Spa 6 Hours, which is it's one of the biggest European historic races. And in terms of, you know, not us, but the people who try to win it, I mean, all the big names are out there. You know, we had cars out there being crewed by Nick Manassian, Alex Brundle, Harrison Newey, all sorts of really... Jim Farley, the chief executive of Ford, was out there and sharing his GT40 with Eric van der Poel, who's been on the podium at Le Mans. I mean, it is a top class field. And then somewhere, well, to be honest, nearer the back of that field, there are a few idiots in a Ford Falcon, which is me, my brother, my nephew Louis, who's been on this podcast before because he works for Bonhams, and usually a certain Mr. Christopher Harris, who was going to race with us this year, but there's a new ruling which says for that particular race you can only have three drivers. I mean, fair play to them, but you know what he did? He drove to Spa to have dinner with us, turned around, and drove back again. So we had an absolutely cracking evening. Wow. And he didn't even get in the car. So thank you, Christopher. Appreciate that. But, it's kind of, to me, what I love about it is it's family, and there's nothing better than racing with your family or with your friends. And we do it in such a... it's a fairly cack-handed way, but it's such an amateurish way. It really is the sort of amateur end of the sport. The car just goes out there, trailed by another car. We have a van full of a few bits, hardly any spares. We kind of cross our fingers, prep the thing as well as we possibly can, go out there, have a huge amount of fun, you know, mucking about, just reconnecting with each other, skidding about. And it's just the wonderful atmosphere, fabulous track. The car, when it's running, is surprisingly quick. Because, I mean, it essentially has a GT40 engine in it. We can't run a dry sump, and we can't run IDA weather cup. So we have enormous holly at one end and a wet sump at the other. But between the two, the bits that move is pure GT40. So we have 470 horsepower. and the car is a lot. Because Ford were very clever when these cars were new. They homologated a huge amount of light bits for them because they knew they were going to race. So it weighs about 1,100 kilos. So it's got 470 horsepower and it weighs less than a McLaren F1. So that gives you, it's sort of got, I suppose, modern GT3 performance in a straight line. But it doesn't stop and it doesn't go around corners. so you just spend, and it's just a hoot. It's got an enormous wheelbase. So it's, you know, it's one of the most benign things you can ever imagine driving. It's pretty massively constructed, despite its light weight, so you feel very secure in it. I mean, there were some enormous accidents out there at the weekend, and, you know, luckily none of them involving us. But if you did have to, I mean, it's one of the reasons. You know, there are so many 26R Lotus Elans, which is the racing Lotus Elans out there, and I just kind of want to put my hands over my eyes every time one of those, you know, loses control, because, you know, you're not going to have a small accident in one of them. And the sense, you know, of reassurance you get when you're surrounded by all that American metal, when there are things pinging off the walls and spinning in front of you and everything else. And, you know, usual spa, the weather was all over the place. And, you know, we were doing quite well. The car ran through its first stint perfectly, which is when my brother was in it. And then Louis got in the car and it was running perfectly. And then 20 minutes before I was due to get in, he came in and said, "I'm terribly sorry, the transmission has gone." And we think what happened was there was either a leak or a crack or oil was coming out of a breather. So for some reason, it lost its transmission oil. The transmission then got super hot, and the heat from that welded the clutch to the flywheel, at which stage that's game over. So I didn't get to race the car. And then to add injury to insult, insult to injury. I drove back to the hotel feeling pretty sorry for myself. And I was going up to my room when something went ping on my telephone, and it was the car app telling me someone had driven into it. And someone had, while the car was parked in the car park, just nerfed the right rear corner of that. So that wasn't much fun either. So, yeah, a kind of weekend to forget. But, yeah, from a racing point of view, it was a complete waste of time. But actually, from a camaraderie point of view, from just, you know, having fun with your mates point of view, it's still a fantastic thing to do. It's quite a long way to go. It's quite expensive when you could just go to the pub. But, yeah, there's a bit of me, you know, there's a lot of me. I've been doing this for so long. I know that, you know, nothing is certain in motor racing until the checkered flag comes out. You know, I have been so lucky on so many occasions. And with that, you have to accept occasionally you're going to get unlucky. And we also rotate the drive. So it was my turn to go last. I went second, I about to say last year, but of course it wasn't. It was pre-COVID, so it was 2019. And I had a wonderful stint in the car. And then Louis got in the car. And I think a wire came off the alternator or something like that. And he was out. So, you know, swings and roundabouts. I won't go last next time. And, you know, we'll be back there this time next year and do it all over again. Hopefully with a better result.
It's so cool that you get to go off and do this every year. And I know quite often it doesn't go exactly how you'd like it to. But it's just a mega thing to get to do, isn't it? I'm very jealous. all right, let's get on to the GT3 RS.
Yeah.
And I think just to sort of set the scene a little bit, I think we should run through some of the technical details and how it's different to the previous RS and to any RS before it, actually. Yeah. You know, I remember reading the press release and I wrote a piece for the app and website. And it's quite clear that there are two ways, really, in which this car is just a leap ahead of any other road-going 911 based Porsche. The first is, well, sort of, this is the smaller one of the two, actually, but there's this amazing level of adjustability with on the steering wheel. You can adjust the bump and rebound on either axle and the differential setting. So that is an extraordinary amount of
adjustability for a road car. And also you have multiple levels of traction and stability. It's not like sort of, you know, it's not like sort of, you know, standard track off. You've got, it's like a racing car where you can have, you know, multiple levels of intervention as well.
Which is amazing. You know, I don't know any car that's offered that level of adjustability. But the big one, it's aero, isn't it? And actually, you only need to look at the car to realise that. I think this is the first time on any road-going Porsche that the rear wing sits higher than the roofline. And I haven't seen the car in person, but presumably when you look at it, the wing, it looks outrageous.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's just the start of it, really. Yeah, the interesting thing with this car is what they haven't tried to do. It's not any lighter. In fact, I think it's 15 kilos heavier than the previous one. It's barely got any more power. I think it's up another 15 horsepower or something. And so I think they've sort of kind of got to the point where they think that they've probably gone as far as they practically can. If, for instance, you want to keep it with a naturally aspirated flat six in it. So the configurability of the suspension and the diff and the electronics is fantastic. But no, it's the aero. It's all about the aero. And, you know, it has active aero front and rear. I guess the big change is, you know, obviously what you can see is the wing. What's more difficult to see, and you might think this is a strange thing to do, is it has a single radiator at the front. 911s, you know, not GT3s normally have three small radiators, one in the middle, two either side. And what they've done is they got rid of the side radiators. They've put one much, much bigger radiator in the middle. In the process, remember this, removing literally all the boot space. Yeah? And you got to think about that, actually, because if you're planning on going anywhere with someone, it's going to be difficult. It's going to be really, really difficult, particularly if, and I imagine most people do, you spec your GT3 RS with a roll cage, because even then that makes even putting something behind the seats really, really difficult. You know, so and that philosophically tells you as much about the car as anything else on it. You know, this is so much more a track honed device that Porsche has thought it a worthwhile, an acceptable sacrifice to basically remove its carrying capacity in the interest of aerodynamics, because that's exactly what they've done. So what that means is you've got that big radiator, and that allows, in the space where the side radiators would have been for aerodynamic flaps under the car, which you can't see, but which are active. And when they are deployed, they increase frontal downforce by over 80%. Yeah? Because the point is, you can have the biggest wing in the world on the back, but if you don't find an appropriate increase of in aero at the front as well, you know, all it's going to do is make the car understeer. It's not actually going to make you any faster at all. So you've got to balance the car. You've got to, if you increase aero grip at one end, you've got to increase it at the other. So you couldn't have a wing that big at the back without those flaps at the front. And that's the point.
Yeah, so that's right. So moving the rad to the middle and then adding the active elements in the front has allowed Porsche to fit that massive rear wing. So it's balanced.
Yes.
And it's, I mean, the outcome is hypercar levels of downforce, you know.
Hypercar plus. I mean, how much? It's got 860 kilos. Is that more than a Senna? I think it is.
Okay, so these are the numbers that I've got here. It's at 124 miles an hour, so well short of top speed. It's generating 409 kilograms, and that's significant because that's double what the previous GT3 RS developed at that same speed, 124 miles an hour.
Yeah.
At 177 miles per hour, that's 860 kilograms. Now, the figure that I've always had in my head, and I have researched this as well just to double check, McLaren claimed 600 kilograms at 160 miles an hour for the P1.
Yeah.
And remember, that had that track mode where it would sit into the ground, that rear wing would rise right up into the air. So, I mean, this GT3 RS, we don't have an exact comparison. At 177, it's producing 860. The P1, at 160 miles an hour, it's generating 600. So, it's, you know, maybe it's a bit more than the P1, which is just staggering for a 911-based car. And that's where the giant stride forward has come, isn't it?
Yeah. And also, you know, some other things they do. So that big central radiator, one problem that created was a huge amount of hot air coming out of that coming out of the bonnet, because it's fine getting all that cold air into it, but then you've got to get all the hot air that results, hot, dirty, unclean air, they call it, out. So it has those nostrils, which are actually really ugly on the bonnet. But what they do is they deflect the hot air down the side of the car, because what they don't want is that hot air going in the engine bay. Andreas Preuninger said that, I can't remember now, but he said there was some statistic, like if you have a 10 degree change in intake temperature, that's about 15 horsepower you lose. And the air coming out of that would be a lot more than 10 degrees hotter than ambient. So that directs the air down the sides of the car. However, what it would then do, if left untreated, is then loop back over the top of the car and still go straight back in the engine bay. So that's why it's got those little strips on the roof. You look at the roof of it, it's got little black strips on it. And they're tiny and they're small. They look vestigial and you think there might be some kind of weird side thing. No, it's not at all. What they do is stop that hot air, which has already gone down the side of the car, from coming back over the top of the car and going back in the engine bay. And it's just, it just gives you an idea of the level of thought. You look at the cutouts behind both the fronts and the rear wheel arches. I mean, this is, you know, it's got a fully panelled underside, which has never happened with any GT3 or any Porsche before. The, you know, the lengths they have gone to get downforce out of it is absolutely extraordinary. And you can feel it from the moment you get in the car on a track.
Mm. Actually, on that point, yeah, this is from the press release that went out a couple of months ago. So, of course, like the new GT3, it has the double wishbone front end. And the suspension arms have a teardrop shape, an aero-optimized teardrop shape, because, says Porsche, the wheel arches are subject to powerful air flows. And so the suspension arms are acting as makeshift wings, contributing at top speed 40 kilograms of downforce.
Just from the front suspension, just from the shape of the front suspension wishbones. So in total terms, okay, in its low downforce configuration, yeah, so with none of the flaps open, and with the DRS, it's got a full DRS system on it.
Yeah.
And with the DRS open, it develops more downforce than a current GT3 set up for track mode, so with the most aggressive wing angle. So it has the least downforce it develops is more than the most downforce the GT3 develops. Mm. Ultimately, it has not only more downforce than a GT3 Cup racing car, it has the same level of downforce, and this what completely blows my mind, as their mid-engine RSR Le Mans car in Le Mans specification. Okay, it has same level as downforce as effectively a prototype Le Mans racing car. I mean, I know it looks like a 911, but, you know, it's mid-engined. It is essentially a prototype. Now, okay, if you put the RSR into high downforce configuration, then it has more downforce. Mm. Which means, and get this, at the Nürburgring, this is a street car on street tyres. In a fast corner, its apex speed is quicker than a GT3 Cup car on slicks.
That's unbelievable. That is unbelievable.
I mean, Jörg Bergmeister, who's a lovely bloke and a long time, you know, he's been a Porsche professional racing driver 20 years. He said to me that when he was driving the GT3 RS around the Nürburgring, he had to remind himself he wasn't in the racing car. And when he was in the racing car, he had to really remind himself that he wasn't in the GT3 RS, because otherwise he might try and go through a quick corner at a speed that this racing car wouldn't go through, which the road car would. So it's just a completely different level. And I guess what they have decided is that, you know, as we said, you know, you can't really make it much lighter. You can't really make it much more powerful. So what area has there been left to develop? Well, there's suspension, and we know what they've done with that. But the big focus is aero, because they've never really done. I mean, I can't find, you know, too many numbers about previous GT3 aerodynamics. I mean, there's a bit here and there, but this one, they have absolutely gone to town on it. And it shows.
It's staggering. Mm. I remember, and I wrote about this a while ago, that I was at the reveal of the 997-2 GT3 RS in 2009. And I remember them telling me that the wing on the previous version, the 997-1, was just a plank of, you know, a straight plank all on one level. And this 997-2 had a little step in the wing, because it would give a more homogeneous load, because it would better sort of match the airflow coming over the car, coming over the arches rather than coming off the roof. And I just thought, wow, they've gone to such detail to put that little step in. And that's nothing,
nothing
compared to what they've done here.
Yeah.
It is extraordinary. And I'm interested to know if you heard a different figure, but I think the top speed is only 184 miles an hour.
Yeah, it's like 15 miles an hour down on a GT3.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, again, you can see that because you come on to... something like the Hanger Straight at Silverstone. So you come out of a quick corner, and we'll get onto this in a minute, but basically going through that combination, you have to hang right back because otherwise you just ram the GT3. So you come onto it, right up the exhaust pipe, and as you get towards the braking area for Stowe, it's just gapping you, it's just pulling away because it has less drag.
That's all that downforce and drag, isn't it?
Yeah.
So last thing to say before we get onto your driving impressions, it's Porsche says available to order now for £178,500.
Good luck with
that. Well, for some people it is, isn't it? And the only thing I wanted to say was I saw over the weekend a Cayman GT4 RS listed for £270,000 on the overs market. Do you think we'll see £500,000 for these?
I do. I absolutely do. Actually, funny enough, I asked Chris exactly that question at Spa and he agreed with me. Yeah. I think we'll see £500,000 for these. Yeah. Said to me, he wasn't, talking statistics, but he was talking anecdotally. But he did say he could have sold the car five times over.
Yeah.
He won't say how many they will produce or how many batches there will be, but he will know from experience. The sort of numbers they'll be able to do. He said they could have sold it five times over.
Unbelievable. Let's get into it.
Yeah.
GT3 RS Silverstone. How wet was it? Was it standing water wet or just damp track wet?
It was what I call wet. Okay.
Okay.
And when I say that, what I mean by it wasn't damp and it wasn't flooded. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So it was just conventionally wet, and actually it was quite consistently wet. Things become a nightmare, and we often get this on quite big tracks, certainly at places like Spa, where you get everything in one lap. It can you can have dried, damp, wet and flooded, right? And it had just sort of like drizzled for a long period of time, so there was enough water there wasn't enough water for huge puddles to develop. It would drain away in time before that happens, but the surface was never remotely dry, and the point with it, the difference between damp and dry, is if it's just damp, a cup 2 tyre, which is what the car was on, get this, just if you order your GT3 RS, there are 3 tyre manufacturers. There's a Goodyear, there's a Pirelli, and there's a Michelin. And you can spec your car down to the most minute detail. All these tiny little lightweight options, this, that, the Visac pack and all that. What you can't do is tell Porsche what tyres you'd like on it.
Yeah. And okay. Is it market dependent or is it potluck?
Well, I wasn't told that. I was told they make more cars come on Michelins than anything else. They, I think, are sort of lead supplier. But you could, and I'm not saying this is a good or a bad thing because I haven't driven it on them, but you could get a GT3 RS tooled up to be the ultimate track day tool and it turns up on a set of Goodyears. And if you want another tyre, you'll have to either wear those out or just buy yourself a set of obviously N-marked Michelins or Pirellis. So anyway, where was I? What was I talking about?
Well, so were you on the Cup 2 or is it a Cup 2 R?
No, so, I mean, Cup 2 R's would have been...
Yeah.
I mean, hopeless. I mean, they would have been useless. Okay. So we were on Cup 2s, but, Cup 2s are a dry track tyre. It's not like a 4S, which has a huge amount of, latitude built into it for wet weather performance. And I can remember thinking, this is going to be interesting, because I've driven cars, many cars on tracks with Cup 2 tyres, and you spend most of the time rather wishing you weren't, because they get quite lively, and it's a bit sort of nervy and so on and so forth. Anyway, so we went out. Everybody had, it was 1-to-1, so it was you and an instructor, and the instructor was in a GT3, also on Cup 2 tyres, and his job, because they were all blokes, was to drive around the track as fast as he possibly could while you followed him. And it was such an eye-opener. You know, I have never in my life, you've done this as many, many times, where you go to a track and it's what we call ducks and drakes. So you have a professional in a lead car, and it's either the same car as yours or usually something faster. And, you know, Mercedes do this with people like Bernd Schneider. And I can remember following Bernd Schneider around the circuit of the Americas, and I was in a AMG GT4 door and he was in a GTR. You know, so you know, good luck with that. But this is the first time in my life where I have been aware of having to work considerably less hard than the bloke I was trying to follow. I mean, the GT3 was... there was barely a corner where it wasn't out of shape. And I'm sure that he had all the tricks turned on and, you know, and was trying to drive as fast as he possibly could. And it was just, it was so instructive. You could just sit there. You just steered the car. And that's when you realise the effect of downforce, even at speeds which you wouldn't necessarily expect to be feeling it. So through things like the Luffield complex, which comes onto the old pit straight, you know, it's a pretty slow corner, but he's still there slithering around. And downforce at those sort of low speeds, it's not giving you, I don't think, massive amounts of extra adhesion. It's just calming the car down a bit. It's just giving you a bit more stability. And that gives you a bit more confidence and so on. And then you get into the quick stuff. And you know, very shortly you learn, as I said, you know, with something like, you know, a quick combination of corners like the Beckett's corner, or a single quick corner like turn one and turn two, I can't remember what they call them on the new circuit, or through like cops, you have to hang right back. Because if you don't, you know, you're just going to be straight up the back of this bloke by the exit. It was, I mean, you know, the fact it was at where it actually really, really helped, because the amount of additional, because you're then deriving so much more grip aerodynamically than you are mechanically in a quick corner, the differences between a car with, you know, a reasonable amount of aero, like a GT3, and an enormous amount of aero, like a GT3 RS, just becomes more and more stark. And I ended up almost, not quite, but almost being glad it was wet, because certainly from a professional point of view and being able to sort of really, because you can sit there in the press conference and hear all the numbers about kilograms, this, that, and the other, but, you know, that's all fine. But, I mean, it was as good a demonstration of what they were talking about as you could possibly imagine. And I, you know, so I did, we each had two sessions, so there was a morning and an afternoon, and so unluckily for me, mine were both wet, which is fine. But at the end of it, and this is all part of what the car will do, it records all your data, and then you go and sit down with somebody from Porsche and they analyze it. And I sat down with Jörg Bergmeister, and he went through it, and he said, well, yeah, all fair enough, but I can just see you're not doing nearly enough under braking. You know, you're making full use of the downforce through the corners. Great, well done, congratulations. But, you know, you're just tickling the brakes. So really? The next time you get towards the end of the hanger straight, you know, remember that downforce doesn't just work in corners. So really pin it, really nail the brakes and see what happens. So I went out again in the afternoon shift and, you know, took his... And my sort of fear was that if you do that in streaming wet conditions in a car on Cup 2s, it's just going to, you know, swap ends on you and that sort of thing. And honestly, it was almost like the track was dry. It was the most impressive braking performance in the wet of any road car I've ever driven.
Wow. Cool.
It just got, you know, and it wasn't sort of, you know, squirreling and squirming about and, you know, requiring correction. Also, it just slowed down. And then obviously what you have to do, and this is a bit of a learning process, but it's not as difficult as it sounds. You have to remember that the slower the car gets, you're losing downforce all the time. And so you get to that point where the downforce is all but gone, and then you need to be braking as you would be in a normal car. So you have to, you know, a massive initial application of the brakes, and then you have to just sort of bleed off the brake pressure all the way into the apex. But as I said, it sounds difficult. It's not. And you actually get used to it very quickly, and then you start to really... exploit it, and it's mesmerizing. What I do want to just talk about a little bit though is whether it's actually more or less fun than a car with no downforce or very little downforce.
Good. I was hoping we're going to get into this, because we've been talking so enthusiastically about all this downforce, but really we need to have a conversation about whether or not it's a good thing.
For certain people, It will be, won't it? You know, and okay, so the argument for, so yeah, the argument for is that this is a track car. This is Porsche going, okay, we'll stop mucking about now. We won't do any of this sort of, you know, hybrid, you know, good for road, good for track. We're just going to do a car which is going to be great on track. And if it's a bit uncomfortable getting there and you can't take any luggage, sorry, guys, but it'll be worth it when you get there. And if you're on a track, in a track car, you know, people want to go fast. I mean, frankly, if you're at a track day, you want to go faster than other people. That's just human nature. You just do. And it'll be brilliant at that. And people will derive their fun and their pleasure from that without any question. I can remember a few years back, must have been in 20. It was sometime in COVID, but I managed to drive the RSR race car, the Le Mans race car. Mm. Which is, as you can imagine, and I drove it at Vallelunga, which was a high downforce circuit, and it's an absolute downforce monster. And I can remember sitting there feeling, frankly, like I was watching a show. It was a demonstration. It was awesome. I didn't feel that involved with it. But I'd also, by that stage, driven a 991 cup car, race car, which has very little downforce, and no traction control, and no stability control, and slicks. And I just loved it. I just loved it because it was so analog and fun. And okay, you couldn't really slide it around like a Mark II rally car because it was quite twitchy, but you really felt you were making a difference. And I felt very at home in that car, very on top of that kind of car, that I understood it. So I've said so many times, haven't I, you cannot confuse fast with fun. And so often fast gets in the way of fun. On the public road, fast absolutely gets in the way of fun. You know, the faster the car is, the bigger and the wider it is, you know, and the faster you have to be going, and so the more antisocially you have to be behaving, the more likely you are to come across traffic, blah, 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 to get the most out of it, which is why we love things like A110s. On a track, it is different. You know, I race very, very old cars. I race a car that's over 100 years old, and it's incredibly slow. And I go around tracking it. And it's a certain sort of fun. There's a certain pleasure in being able to operate one of these ancient devices and that sort of thing. But it's a very particular thing. I think that there is, on a racetrack, an enormous amount of fun to be had from driving very, very fast. And it's a totally different feeling to driving very, very fast on a public road, which frankly scares me. I don't really like driving very fast on public roads because it's the wrong environment. It's not what that environment was designed to support. A racetrack exists to provide you with that environment. And I think in that environment, yeah, I would say it is fun. It is enormous amounts of fun. It's a more cerebral kind of fun. It's not like a belly laugh, let's go sideways kind of fun. It's not that. It's an experience, and it's also fascinating because you're learning so much. You're learning, you know, about a road car doing things that road cars aren't, you know, supposed to be able to do. So that's fun too. So yeah, absolutely, it is fun. What you now need to ask me is, if I could do one more lap, would I do it in a GT4 RS or a GT3 RS?
If you could do one more lap, would you do it in a GT4 RS or GT3 RS?
I was kind of hoping you wouldn't ask me that question, Dan. it's difficult. Well, you'll be able to answer the question, actually, when you drive, hopefully, the GT3 RS in the dry, because I haven't driven a GT4 RS in the wet, and I haven't driven a GT3 RS in the dry. I think probably the GT3 RS, but I don't know. I really don't know. Because the GT4 RS is such great fun. But that's a much more conventional kind of fun, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, I'm still fascinated by the GT3 RS because I couldn't quite believe what it could do. And it may be the novelty wears off and it just becomes normal like everything else once you're used to what it can do. But I suspect you'll still be going so much faster than anything else out there. It never will, but I don't know. I mean, an amazing car. And I can't give it a 10 out of 10 rating, even if I wanted to. And I'm not sure that I would, because I do think the luggage space is an issue. But, you know, we had this with the 600LT McLaren, which I wasn't allowed to drive on the road. I'm not ever going to give a car a maximum rating if it's a road car and I can't drive it on the road. You know, but it's clearly a 9 out of 10 car.
9 out of 10. Crikey. You haven't driven it on the road. I'm not going to drive it on the road next week. Does it fit? When you rattled over a few curbs, did it feel especially stiff in terms of its springing?
It's so difficult to say. I mean, I'm certainly not going to come up with any kind of verdict. But we know, don't we, that a GT3... its ride is compromised over a 991 GT3. We've said that on the road, and that it is less good as a road car as a result. We know, too, that the suspension of the GT3 RS is 50% stiffer than that of a GT3, and that is a like-for-like comparison because you're comparing a wishbone car to a wishbone car. So I'm speculating. I would say that in theory, its ride is going to be a lot worse. However, let us not forget what you can do with those dampers.
Yeah.
And I asked Preuninger this, and he smiled, and he said, actually, that's a very good question. So what I asked him was, if you set, because you can only adjust the dampers when the car's in track mode, if you set everything to as soft as possible in track mode, does it actually ride better than it does in whatever the standard comfort mode is? And he went, Andrew, that is a very good question to ask, and yes, it does.
Wow.
So the car rides best in track mode. Because that gives you access to the configurability on the dampers. So again, it's another reason to drive a GT3 RS. We need to find these things out, don't we? You know, imagine if it did ride better than a GT3, then the only thing which would get in the way was the fact you can't put any bloody luggage in the thing.
Blimey, yeah, there's still a lot to learn about this car, isn't there?
And then there is the inevitable Nürburgring question, isn't there?
They tried, and
the great German weather got in the way because they were being very unkind about British weather at Silverstone, understandably. so they don't know, but you know what they think, and this just shows you how far the car has moved the dial in terms of downforce. They've done simulations which say that the car will not be quite as quick around the Nürburgring as the GT2 RS of, what, 2018?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But as Andy Preuninger said to me, we usually do better on our simulations. So the unofficial target is to at least match the time of a GT2 RS. Just think about that for a second. It's going to go as fast around a car, around a track, with some very, very long straights...
Yeah.
As only 4 years ago, a car went with another 170 horsepower and a massive amount of additional torque. And they think it's certainly in with a chance of going quicker than a GT2 RS. They don't think they'll get to the time that the... Do you remember there was also that Manti prepped GT2 RS, which I think is still the fastest road car to go around the ring. They don't think they're going to get that, but they think it'll go as quick as a standard GT2 RS. If it does that... I mean, again, what better demonstration of the aero properties of that car than that? It's extraordinary.
It sounds like you didn't get a load of wheel time, so I presume you haven't had any chance to fiddle with the configurability.
No, not at all. I thought I'd let you do that at Dunsfold. Yeah. No, my car was set up by a bloke called Mark Webber. which I kind of thought would be... No, so we had four laps, I think. And then I did, I think, another two laps because I wanted to do a bit talking into a microphone. And then there was the afternoon session and I had another four laps. So I think I've probably done 10 laps, all in the wet. If you're going to do something like that, I don't think there's any point in fiddling with stuff like that unless you're going to have...
No, there isn't.
A day, frankly, just sitting there, because there are so many, if you think about the adjustments you can make to the traction and the stability and the bump and the rebound and the aero and the diff, put all those into a pot, that's a lot of stirring which needs to be done. In 10 laps, we get it. More important for me just to understand the basic properties of the car. Just to take a baseline setup for the conditions, which Mark very kindly did, and then to assess the car on that basis. So hopefully at Dunsfold, I think that's one of the reasons you're going, isn't it? You're just going to have a really proper play with all those little things. And I'm so looking forward to talking to you and reading the story you'll write about, How big is the difference? How much more stable is me? How do you set up the diff? What is, people always go on about, I adjusted for another two stops of bump and another three for rebound. What does that all mean? What are the actual effects of that? What I'm really hoping for, not that I'm sort of giving you a brief here or anything, is just that, you not only explain what this stuff is, what it does, but also what difference it makes. And, you know, maybe you drive the car with everything perfect for the track that you're on, and then you make everything as bad as humanly possible.
Well, that's right. See,
yeah.
I'd love to learn how much of a difference you can make by fiddling with all these settings.
Yeah, but also I want to know whether you, as a, you know, as a good and experienced driver, if you just go out like one click on something, can you feel that?
Mm.
I don't know. And if you can't feel it, what's the point of it?
Well, I'm just, as you suggest, really hoping that it's dry, because that will give me a better chance. You know, more consistent conditions, a better chance of learning this stuff. But it's going to be fascinating, and I just hope that we have plenty of time. And well, you need a race engineer there, really, to talk you through this stuff.
Yeah.
So I also hope
that you, A, that it's dry, and if it is dry, you get to drive it on Cup 2 hours, because I imagine it'll just tear your head off. It'll be absolutely terrific. You're going to come back in a neck brace.
Yeah.
It'll be fantastic.
God, I'm excited now. Bloody hell. Further into the future at some point. It might not happen this year because the weather's turning, but we have to drive it on the road, don't we?
We do.
Try and figure out if it's totally compromised or if they've done something super clever and made it work on the highway, which would be an astonishing thing to have done.
Can I say two more things about it?
Yes,
okay, well, just remember... And this is the amazing thing. We're sitting here a bit being blown away by what this thing can do. It's the Gen 1 car.
Oh, good point.
Yeah?
And they always leave something in their back pocket, don't they?
They always leave something. You know, if you think of the leap the 997 GT3 RS took, you leap the 991 GT3 RS took between Gens 1 and 2, you know, they know already what they're going to do for the second. I can't even imagine what they're going to do for the second generation of this car. And the other thing, which I think people will want to know the answer to, is obviously because there's never been a Gen 1 GT2 RS. We weren't expecting one with this generation. Will there be a Gen 2 GT RS? They have a real problem with emissions. It's called Euro 7. There's a new wave of emissions legislation coming in. It depends when it hits. It depends exactly what it said, but at the moment they're going to really struggle to even maintain the power level of the existing car. So I spoke to Andreas Preuninger, and Andreas is a man who is as honest as the day is long, and he said, honestly, there are no plans at the moment. We are thinking about it. We're working out if we can even do it. So. Jury's out. We don't even know if there's going to be another GT2 RS. But just imagine, A, the leap from Gen 1 to Gen 2 GT3 RS, and then that Gen 2 car with at least the same power as an old GT2 RS. It's going to be quite silly.
That would be utterly staggering. We'll have to wait.
They should just do it, because they'd sell them. They should just do it anyway and just go, well, here's the Gen 2 GTRS. This is exactly the car we always wanted to make. It's got 800 horsepower, and the only drawback is you can't drive it on the road.
Yeah.
They'd sell them.
Yeah, but people would have them.
Yeah, of course they would.
And
to just do it anyway. And just two finger salute.
Imagine what that would be like.
It'll be unbelievable.
Okay.
Andy, if you're listening to this, do it.
Do it, please. Yeah, just because I want to go. All right, well, that's the GT3 RS. Lots more still to learn, but I think we learned a lot today. There's a listener question coming up. Again, you've not been briefed. You won't struggle with this one, I don't think. But before we get on to the listener question, please, please, everyone, remember to rate and review the podcast. I say this every week. I can see you all doing it. I really appreciate it, but it really makes a difference. Also, subscribe or follow wherever you listen to this podcast. That helps a lot. And go and check out the-intercooler.com, our beautiful new-ish website, 3 months in. It looks great. We're posting what I think are some wonderful stories, but you'll have to go and figure out for yourself if they're for you. You can start your free trial for a month.
Yeah, we've already got over 1,000 stories and over 1 million words on there.
Yeah.
You know, but I think people look at websites and they think they're sort of here today, gone tomorrow things in terms of the content that they post, and they kind of just sort of, you know, and because so many of our stories are timeless, you know, if you go on there, you could spend months of your life reading stuff that you'd never read before, which is all there in our library, and just, you know, just treat it like a library, just go in there and, you know, sit down and browse about. There's so many amazing stories from so many wonderful writers. We are terribly, terribly proud of it. And, you know, I hope not too arrogant, we think it's worth a pint of beer a month, which is what it costs. So yeah, go and have a look.
Go and check it out, the-intercooler.com. Okay, the listener question comes from John. And he asks, what cars taught you the most about driving? As a driving enthusiast, which were the cars that really made things click for you? Now, while you give that some thought, I will answer. And I've got two. I had two cars that came to mind. The first was my mum's Ford Focus LX, the one that I drove when I was 17, 1.6. And, well, partly because, as we all know, that first generation Focus was a benchmark car for everyday family cars. Steers beautifully, handles, rides wonderfully. So you learn a lot because of that. But also, it was the first car that I really spent a lot of time in. And so inevitably, you're going to learn a lot. But the other one that really made something specific click for me was a very Boggo Caterham 7 at a wet Bruntingthorpe. It was the first time I ever really remember properly drifting, power sliding a car. Yeah. I'd never done it before. Yeah. And in that one day, probably in an hour, just learned so much and started to get comfortable with that feeling of using the power to provoke a slide and hold a car in a drift and then bring it out again. And anybody who drives a 7 for the first time, particularly on track or particularly on a wet track, or even just a kind of apron, you know, when you do one of those things where you're skidding around cones in a car park, you'll learn so much because they're such raw, pure, stripped back, light, small cars. You can't fail to.
Yeah, okay. I completely agree with all of that. For me, it was, it was a 205 GTI. When I was 19, I'd inherited a bit of money from somebody who died. I was also working in the city, so I was briefly earning a bit of money, and I could afford the £6,495 that you had to pay for a 1.6 litre 205 GTI. This would have been 1985. It was a B-reg car, which I think is 85. And before that, I'd had, you know, I'd had two CVs and, you know, I'd had a Metro and that sort of thing. But then I got in the 205 and I took it down to Goodwood for my first ever track day. And I just kept on falling off the track. I just spun it here, spun it there. And I didn't know what I was doing. And later, I think I was in the pub with my older brother who was racing Alphas at the time. And I was just saying to him, you know, this car's just all over the place. I can't control it. I don't know what I'm doing wrong. And he said, he asked me what I was doing, and he said, well, that's what's going wrong. You're just driving the car completely incorrectly. What you're doing with the throttle pedal is the absolute opposite of what you're doing. And when you get in trouble, you put your foot on the brake, and that's why you fall off. So he said, just go to a roundabout and just drive it around a roundabout at a constant speed, and then just keep your steering angle the same and just increase and decrease the throttle and see what happens. You don't need to be on the limit, you just need to be going quite fast. So I went to the roundabout onto the Westway, the top of the M41 in London. This was, yeah, whatever it was, 30 something years ago. So I hope I won't get prosecuted for this now. But it was the middle of the night, it was 2 o'clock in the morning, there was nothing around there. And I just went round and round this roundabout. And what I discovered, and this won't surprise anybody, but I literally didn't know at the time, is that if you lifted off slightly, the car would tuck into the apex. And if you powered on, it would push away, this being a front-wheel drive car. And I became absolutely mesmerized by it. I could describe any angle I liked around this roundabout simply by using the accelerator pedal. My hands didn't move on the steering wheel. I could take a line all the way around the inside. I could go all the way around the outside. I could go in. I could go out. And I suddenly thought, shit, this is what people mean by steering a car on the throttle. Because I thought it was all about, you know, drifting and power slides and everything. And it is a bit of that, obviously. But actually, far more usefully and relevantly than that, it's just about being able to adjust your line through a corner in a way that, frankly, your passenger probably wouldn't even notice. And you needed a car like a 205 GTI, which was so beautifully responsive, to really understand that concept. And suddenly, I felt the change from being somebody who was capable of operating a machine which took him from one place to another to someone who could drive. And it was it was one evening, you know, back in 1985, when I stopped being an operator and became a driver. I'll never forget it.
Crikey. Good answer. And a great question. Thank you, John. So please get your listener questions across. I'm not going to get into it now, Andrew, but you reminded me. Last week, I drove a 2CV for the first time.
No!
I did.
Which one? I did.
And I'll save it because I'm going to write a story okay. soon.
Save
but
it.
Also an SM, also a traction event, also a BX. So lots to discuss next week.
Oh, fantastic. Really looking forward to it.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.